Welcome to the Deadcast.
Now, let me refer you back to your statement that you gave Officer Ridge. Did you tell him in that statement that you had been a member of a white witch group for 5 years?
No.
Okay.
I've never been a member of any group.
And so, if he put that in his report, you're saying that's inaccurate?
Yes, I am.
He made that up?
Yes, I am.
On question number 9, how do you think it would, the person feels they did this? The answer was probably makes them feel good, gives them power. Now, I guess Officer Ridge said that too.
No, I use common sense on that. If someone's doing it, then they must have wanted to. And if they were doing something they wanted to, it must have made them happy. I don't think they were doing it because someone forced them to or because they didn't want to.
So in your mind, the person that killed these 3 kids, it's common sense that killing 3 8-year-olds would make you feel good.
Whoever did it, it must have.
Did you also tell him that each person had a demonic side to them?
I believe every person has a good side and a bad side, yes.
Well, were those your words when you referred, when he got written down here, he stated that there was no control of the demonic portion of people?
He asked me, did I think there were some people that could not control that side? I said, yes, I guess there is.
It also states that Damien stated that the younger the victim would be more innocent, and in turn, more power would be given the person doing the killing.
Right.
Did you say that?
Yes.
Hey, those are your words.
Mm-hmm.
Did you pick that up when you were studying to be a Catholic?
No. I saw that on several movies, books.
Question number 11. When he asked you, how do you think they died? His answer is mutilation, cut up all 3, heard they were in the water drowning, cut up one more than the others. Is that, again, what Officer Ridge said and you just agreed?
No, I had saw that on TV, newspapers, people talking.
And you knew it about the drowning, correct?
I knew they were in the water. I didn't know that they drowned.
You knew that one was cut up more than the others?
He asked me, was it possible? He said, do you think one was hurt worse than the others? I said, yeah, I guess.
So again, that particular area is one of those things where Officer Ridge told you, and that wasn't your response. You just responded about the drowning and mutilation.
If he didn't get the answer he liked, he would go back and try to get me to say something else.
And it's your testimony specifically that you aren't the one who said one was cut up more than the other.
No,
that it was Officer Ridge who said that.
I agreed with him when he said that.
Okay. And if he says something different, he'd be lying about it, right? You're the one telling the truth.
I wouldn't put it past him.
I knew from when I was real small that people were going to know who I was. I always had that feeling. I just never knew how they were going to learn. I kind of enjoy it because now even after I die, people are going to remember me forever. They're going to talk about me for years. People in West Memphis will tell their kids stories. It'll be like, sort of like I'm the West Memphis boogeyman. Little kids will be looking under their bed before they go to bed. Damien.
Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me once again as we look into the case of the West Memphis 3. This is the last week we're going to be looking at this case. Now, before we get into it, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram at Ian Totten Author. You can find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author. I am also on Twitter at Author Totten. And every other form of social media you can think of, I can be found under Author Totten. If you would like to help support the show, you can find me on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. I'm also on Venmo and PayPal if you'd like to make a one-time donation to the show and help with the production. Now that the plugs are out of the way, and before I dive into this, this is being recorded on Saturday, January 9th, 2021. And as I'm sure all of the listeners I have worldwide know, we had some pretty heavy stuff happen here in the United States. And I am not political in any way, shape, or form. So I don't want people to take this as me going on a political rant. But I do have one thing to say given what's gone on in this country. I'm a 4-year veteran of the United States Navy. I am also a combat veteran, and the stuff that I saw this past week in this country from both sides of the political spectrum is absolutely disgusting. From the charging of the Capitol building to the way that Democrats have reacted towards people with a different ideological view than themselves. And I just wanted to take a moment to say, you're all Americans. Get over yourselves. Look at each other and realize that we got into the situation we are in because you two groups are at each other's throats and fighting. And nothing can be accomplished in this country unless we stop acting like petulant children and realize that we're all in this together and that we need to compromise and come together as a nation and as people, and we need to treat one another as people, not as an enemy. All I've seen for the last few days is conservatives going berserk online and liberals acting like conservatives are the scum of the earth. It's abso-fucking-lutely disgusting. Every one of you should be ashamed of yourself. People died on the 6th. People have been dying all year in the protests and the riots that erupted at some of the protests. And we're all acting like it's the other side's fault that this happened. No. This has happened because both sides have forgotten what it means to be an American and to be a human being. Doesn't matter if you're black, white, brown, yellow, whether you like Donald Trump or hate him, whether you're like Joe Biden or you hate him. We are human beings, first and foremost, before any party allegiance bullshit. And if you can't get that through your head, maybe you don't need to listen to my show because it's obvious you're too fucking stupid to grasp any concept of reality. You're so far up your own asses freaking with your political ideology and hating one another that you cannot figure out that none of that shit matters. What matters is being a decent human being to one another. I don't care if the person standing next to you is wearing a Trump hat. Somebody hits them in the side of the head with a frickin' brick. Pick them up. Make sure they're okay. You see somebody with a Biden bumper sticker on their car to get slammed by a fucking semi-truck, pull over and make sure they're all right. That's called being a human being instead of a mindless, brain-dead fucking moron. Which is all I have seen online for the last 3 or 4 days, and it's absolutely disgusting. As I said, I served the United States Navy for little over 4 years, and what I have seen from my fellow countrymen over the last week makes me be ashamed to be associated with any of you. And I tell you right now, if I had to go back and do it over again, given what I've seen the American people do to each other, I wouldn't do it because you're not worth it. You're not worth being protected because you treat one another like garbage. The whole fucking situation is disgusting, and every single one of you people that fucking are a Democrat or a Republican should be ashamed of yourselves and should look at each other and apologize for being assholes. That being said, if any of you are still listening, grab yourself something to drink, sit down in a chair or on a couch, kick your feet up, shut the outside world out, close your eyes, and relax. I've got my coffee, I got my cigarettes, I'm ready to talk some true crime and help us all take our minds off of this stuff. So let's go into the crypt. So as you heard in the trailer, there were a couple of clips from the trial of Damien Eccles. That was actually from when Damien was on the stand. And reason I did that was A, to change out the trailer for this week, but also to give you a bit of how he was back in 94. There's other clips that are available online. In fact, there's one YouTuber by the name of Alex J. Hidell, that's H-I-D-E-L-L, who has a number of the audio recordings from the trial up on his page. And if you're really into this case, it's a good place to swing by and listen. You know, give him a like and let him know what you think of what he posted. Because the things that were in the Paradise Lost films painted a very different picture from what actually took place in the courtroom. See, the Paradise Lost movie painted a picture of Jason and Jesse and Damien as being these sweet, kind, misunderstood individuals, but the reality is they were anything but. And when Damien did get on the stand, he was fairly combative with the prosecutors, and at one point he admitted that he changed his alibi to suit a given situation. And when questioned about this later by his lawyer, he said that he had been daydreaming, when personally I think it was that he slipped up and actually told the truth. And I say that because I believe at this point Jesse had already been convicted, which we're going to get into, but he had realized the severity of the situation that he and Jason were actually in. It wasn't a kid's game anymore, which unfortunately, you know, during the court proceedings, there's a lot of pictures of Damien assing off and, you know, using a mirror to make sure his hair looks perfect for the cameras and flipping people off and goofing off and laughing, which belies the fact of how serious the situation was and shows you that he didn't think that they could convict him for what he had done. It was a very arrogant portrayal he had in the courtroom. Again, I'm using the Callahan site and the excellent books by Gary Meese, Where the Monsters Go, and I believe it's the second book is called Blood on Black, which pretty much cover every aspect of this case. I know myself and a number of other people consider Gary to be an expert on this case, and it's a little humbling he's actually started following the show. Which, to have an expert on something that you are going over, you know, take an interest in what you're doing, is mind-blowing. Just as it's mind-blowing to me the amount of listeners that I have been gaining since this show has started. Anyways, last week I left off, we were talking about the three killers' alibis, and how they really did not have any alibis that stood up under scrutiny. So we're going to do a pretty quick timeline. On June 3rd, 1993, Damien, Jason, and Jesse were all arrested, and each of them were charged with three counts of murder. The next day, Detective Gitchell held a press conference to announce the arrests, and he told the reporters there that on a scale of 1 to 10, as far as how positive he was they had gotten the right men, he felt it was an 11. On the 7th, the state appointed lawyers for each of the defendants. On August 4th, Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly attended a pretrial hearing before Judge David Burnett in Marion, Arkansas. Marion's right next to the West Memphis. and he ruled that Miss Kelly should be tried separately from the other two, as well as that Miss Kelly's confession could be used in Eccles and Baldwin's trial. The other important note from that day is that it was ruled that the defendants would each be tried as an adult rather than juveniles. And a character came into the trials at this point, a private investigator named Ron Lax. Initially, he said he was going to donate his services to the defense team, although later he would send them a bill for the work he had done. And this is speculation, although there is some evidence to support this. But basically what Ron did was he went around and intimidated, supposedly, lest any lawyers for his family or anyone else be listening, he supposedly went around and intimidated potential witnesses against the West Memphis Three, which is why a number of individuals were not brought in as witnesses for the prosecution. Now, a lot of these people that were not brought in were underage, and it's been suggested that they had been intimidated, but the people who didn't come in because they refused to testify. Now, there was a bunch of different pretrial things going on from this point onward. It was decided that Miss Kelly's trial would start in January of 1994, while both Eccles and Baldwin will be tried together in February in Jonesboro, Arkansas. November 17th of 1993, divers discovered a knife in the lake behind the Baldwin household. It was about 50 feet from shore. This is the knife that I discussed last week, the so-called lake knife. It's about 9 inches long with a serrated edge. And try and help you visualize where this thing was found. Lakeshore Trailer Park. That's the lake that's in Lakeshore Trailer Park. It's really more of a scum-covered pond filled with trash and other debris. And it is possible that this was the knife that was used in the killings. Everything was pretty quiet for the next few months while the state and defenses prepared to go to trial. In January of 94, jury selection began for Miss Kelly's trial. It was a fairly quick trial. Jesse was convicted on one count of first-degree murder and 2 counts of second-degree murder, for which he was sentenced to 40 years. Now, Jesse was going to be sent to the Corrections Institute at Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and during his transportation there, he began talking with the officers who were transporting him, and they advised him of his rights, but Jesse kept talking, and this is the second time that he confessed without coercion. And both of these officers then turned around and let their superior, Inspector Gitchell, know about this conversation and that Jesse had confessed again. This was quickly followed a few days later by what has become known as the Bible Confession. See, word got back to Miss Kelly's lawyer, I believe Dan Stidham, that he had confessed to the police again. And naturally, you know, this was going to mess up their chances of appealing his conviction. So Stidham went up to the prison and began talking with Jesse. And Miss Kelly started spilling his guts, at which point Stidham stopped him and went and retrieved a Bible as well as a tape recorder. Now, it was just the two of them in the room together. Again, this was an uncoerced confession. Miss Kelly pretty much told his lawyer that he had lied to the cops on a couple of different areas in his initial confession, specifically having to do with the time of day it took place, and what was used to tie up the boys. And the reason he gave for this was that he was trying to trick the cops to see what it was that they actually knew. And when Stidham asked why he was telling him this, Miss Kelly said it was because he had asked him to put his hand on the Bible, and if the police had done that, he would have told them the truth. I'm going to read a quick excerpt from Miss Kelly's confession to Dan Stedman. "Okay, Jesse. A few minutes ago, I asked you about making some statements to the officers when they transported you from Piggott to Pine Bluff. You told me that you had told them some stuff. Is that correct?" Miss Kelly: "Yes, sir." Stidham: "And at first you told me that you were just making it up, that you were lying to them, and then you placed your hand on the Bible and told me that you were there when those boys got killed." Miss Kelly: "Yes, sir." What's the truth, Jesse? I want to know the truth." Miss Kelly: "The truth is, me and Jason and Damien did it." Stidham: "You were there when the boys were killed?" Miss Kelly: "Yes, sir." Stidham: "Now, what's going to be very important is for you to tell me why it was that you have been maintaining that you weren't there all the time." Miss Kelly: "I was scared." Stidham: "What were you scared of?" Miss Kelly: "I always lied, and I hadn't ever put my hand on the Bible and swore. Nobody didn't tell me to do that. If they would have told me that at first, I would have done it. Nobody told me to put my hand on the Bible." "Okay, so basically you've been lying to me and Mr. Crow for the past 7 or so months about not being there when in fact you were there?" Miss Kelly: "Yes, sir." "Okay, Jesse, let's start from the beginning. I understand that you'd received a phone call from Jason sometime before the murders. Remember when that was?" Miss Kelly: "On Monday." And Miss Kelly did tell Stidham that, you know, he could prove that what he was saying was true, as he had been drinking that evening. Vicky Hutchinson, you know, the one who had seen Damien and Dominique Tier walking near the crime scene, had gone out and bought him a bottle of Evan Williams whiskey. And in Miss Kelly's confessions, he had stated that he was drinking and that Damien and Jason were drinking as well, although they were drinking beer. Miss Kelly said that after he left the murders, he was really upset by what had happened. He had gotten sick, and that he had smashed the Evan Williams bottle underneath a very specific overpass. And after leaving the jail, Stedman decided, you know, he was believing him but not fully. He decided that they needed to go see if they could find this bottle underneath the overpass. So he and another lawyer drove out to this overpass in the middle of the night, and lo and behold, they found the smashed Evan Williams bottle underneath the overpass. And I'm not talking, you know, just shards of busted glass. They actually found the bottle with part of the label still attached to it. And at that point, Stedman knew that Miss Kelly was telling the truth. Now, a few days later, Miss Kelly decided that he wanted to confess yet again, this time to the prosecutors against Dan Stedman's objections. There's this false narrative out there that Miss Kelly was pressured by the prosecutors to confess to them. That never happened. What happened was Miss Kelly decided he wanted to talk to them because he needed to get it off his chest. And Dan Stedman was there, and he pleaded with Miss Kelly not to speak with them because he knew that it would severely hamper their chances of appealing his conviction. but Miss Kelly was not to be dissuaded. Another part of this false narrative is that the prosecutors had promised Miss Kelly that his girlfriend would be allowed to come and visit him in the prison. This, too, never happened, at least not in the way that the West Memphis 3 supporters like to paint the picture. Miss Kelly had asked if his girlfriend would be able to come up and visit him, and the prosecutor told him he wasn't certain that that would be able to happen, and asked Miss Kelly, knowing this, if he still wished to proceed with his confession. And Miss Kelly agreed to continue with his confession, knowing that it was probably not going to happen that his girlfriend would come and visit him. So after this confession, Miss Kelly agreed to testify for the prosecution, although a few days later he did change his mind and decide that he was not willing to testify. The same day that Miss Kelly decided he was not going to testify, the Baldwin-Eccles trial opened, and it doesn't seem like either Eccles or Baldwin put on much of a defense. I mean, if you can see film footage from it, Jason Baldwin pretty much sits there playing the scared, frightened child while Damien is laughing and joking with his lawyers and people who are in the gallery. The entire time, the Baldwin defense was basically playing damage control and trying to keep as much of Damien's dirt off of their client, and there was a lot of dirt. The prosecutors called a ton of witnesses who all offered pretty damning testimony in regards to Damien Eccles. And it was during their trial that this whole myth about animal predation on the bodies, which would account for the wounds, came up. And supporters have taken to this, with some believing that a pack of roving dogs actually dragged the boys' bodies into the water after the real killers supposedly had left their bodies, while others believe that a group of ravenous, fast-moving snapping turtles had descended upon the bodies that were in the water. It's true there are snapping turtles in the 10-mile bayou. However, the area where the bodies were was more of a runoff. It wasn't actually part of the bayou itself. And in fact, when the police drained that area of Robin Hood Hills after the murders, they found no signs that snapping turtles had been in the area at all. Now, mind you, snapping turtles are like other turtles. They're not extremely fast animals. It's even been stated by a number of officers who worked the case that if they had been in the water when the bodies were found, more likely than not, they would have encountered turtles at that point. But none were seen. So again, this idea that animals had inflicted the wounds on the boys is absolute fantasy. Now, moving on. On March 18th of 1994, Eccles and Baldwin were both found guilty of capital murder, 3 counts each, and on the 21st, they were sentenced. Baldwin was sentenced to life in prison, while Eccles, who was seen as the main catalyst of the murders, was sentenced to death. Now, Baldwin went to join Miss Kelly at Pine Bluff Prison, while Eccles was sent to death row at Varner. Naturally, they appealed their cases not long after this, but because of the evidence that was presented at trial, as well as Miss Kelly's multiple confessions, they were denied. Now, the three of them were pretty much forgotten about and left to rot in prison until 1996, when Paradise Lost, the child murders of Robin Hood Hills, came out on HBO. It was a documentary, and I've discussed that briefly before in the previous episodes. When I originally saw the film, I walked away from it thinking, man, these three kids were railroaded. You know, they're not guilty. And that is because the filmmakers had presented a very slanted view of the case and the facts involved in it. Berlinger and Sanofsky are known for doing this. They admit to doing this. In fact, one of them stated that after meeting Eccles for only a moment or two, he knew that the boy was innocent, and as a consequence, they decided to do whatever they could in the film to show them in the most positive light possible. And this is what led to what became known as the Free the West Memphis 3 movement. And it's a movement that's built entirely on lies. A few years ago, I came across the Callahan site, and that's when I started reading all the case files and the stuff that was not included in the documentaries. And it was really an eye-opening experience. I know a lot of other people have had this experience as well, because the picture that is painted for you is much, much different than the one that the films present. Any rate, after the first Paradise Lost movie came out, various social justice warriors in Hollywood became attached to it, and they worked tirelessly in an attempt to get Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly released. And eventually a second Paradise Lost film came out, and I remember watching it with my wife, and it just seemed that something was off from this film. It didn't have the same vibe to the first one. For one thing, it focused much more on John Mark Byers, who was the stepfather of one of the children, and it painted him in a light that he was, in fact, responsible for the murders. There was a scene where he was drunk out of his mind in Robin Hood Hills, lighting a fire and screaming and crying about the boys. It came out quite a bit later after this film came out that the Berlinger and Sanofsky had actually paid Byers something, an obscene amount, like $500 an hour, to work on the film with them and to act in the film. And you know, he didn't know what they were doing when they were making the film, but afterwards he realized pretty quickly, oh shit, these guys are trying to pin these murders on me so they can get their buddies out. So for a couple years there, he was kind of fighting for his survival, because now the West Memphis 3 supporters were onto him. And eventually the supporters were able to convince him somehow to come and join him, which is apparent in the third West Memphis 3 movie, the third Paradise Lost, which my wife and I watched and found absolutely disinteresting, because at this point I had read Eccles' book from prison, where he was talking about how he was meditating and all of this stuff. And even something in that book seemed off. It seemed like I was being fed, a crock of shit. He was talking about how he was dying in prison, even though they could find nothing medically wrong with him. And basically what it boils down to was him pissing and moaning over the fact that he was caught for the crime that he had committed and was no longer allowed to be free among polite society. The other thing of note from that film before we get to how they ended up getting out of prison is the fact that they switched their focus from Mark Byers and instead turned to Terry Hobbs, and he has become the favored suspect of their West Memphis 3 supporters, despite having no evidence other than the fact that the man has a temper and that at one point he got into an argument with Pam Hobbs' brother and somehow ended up shooting the man. Which, despite, you know, what they want to say, he shot a man in a drunken argument does not make him a triple child murderer. So, throughout the years, they've tried bringing up various suspects and that there's other DNA evidence that, you know, proves it wasn't them. One bit of evidence they found stated that, you know, didn't belong to any of the murderers. One hair did belong to Terry Hobbs. In fact, it was found in the knots on his son. However, they lived together. It's very possible he may have had a hair from his father on him. In fact, it's more than probable. It'd be odd if he didn't. And that hair, which, you know, had been transferred to him, ended up somewhere at the crime scene. One small thing of note is that in 2003, Vicki Hutchinson decided that, you know what, all the stuff I told the police was a lie. I said it because they wanted to, or they told me they were going to take my son if I did not say it. However, Vicki Hutchinson has also been known to lie about many other things, and the stories that she gave the police concerning seeing Eccles and Dominie Teer, or possibly Jason Baldwin, near the crime scene did not change from telling to telling, and it's more likely that the West Memphis 3 supporters got to her and put pressure on her in order to get her to recant her story. I'm not certain on this, so it's speculation, but I believe, or it's my opinion, that there may have been some drugs involved in her life, either at the time of the killings or after. I'm not certain on that. Again, it's just speculation on my part. Another maneuver they tried was to get the case thrown out, claiming jury misconduct, which again fell on deaf ears. The courts knew the correct men were in prison and basically ruled that whether a member of the jury talked to a police officer or not before the trial was irrelevant, as the evidence showed that the three men incarcerated were there for good reason. During this, Eccles married while he was on death row to a lady, Lori something or other. She's apparently an architect from New York City. She moved down to the area and was smitten by the lines that Eccles fed her. And the two of them have a pretty different type of relationship. I've read a couple of letters that they had sent back and forth between each other that were found in a storage unit they left when they took off from Arkansas. And it's not a normal kind of relationship at all. Personal opinion, again, she's just, you know, what they call a star fucker. In November of 2010, the Arkansas Supreme Court ordered a judge to rule on whether new DNA evidence would exonerate the three men or not. However, remember, Damien Echols was on death row at this point, and the state of Arkansas had spent a ton of money dealing with these people. So before the judge could ever turn around and rule on this DNA evidence, which, by the way, has never been released by the defense team, which is telling, as my suspicion is it probably does not exonerate their clients, despite the fact that they continue to this day to claim that they have DNA evidence. A deal was struck between the prosecution and the defense team for an Alford plea. Now, basically what an Alford plea means is that the prosecution has enough evidence to secure a conviction while the defendants agree to plead guilty while still maintaining their innocence. And this was apparently a pretty hard-fought battle for the defense lawyers to get all of the participants to agree to, as Jason Baldwin refused for quite a bit of time to even entertain the idea of pleading guilty. And he says now that the reason he did it was in order to get Damien off of death row. But more than likely, he was leaned on by everybody to, look, you want to get out of prison, this is the only way you're getting out because they've got enough evidence to keep you in here for the rest of your life. Which, going back to the DNA evidence, says to me that the defense team knew that the DNA evidence that they had was complete garbage. So, in 2011, the West Memphis 3 agreed to the plea agreement and were released from prison after serving 18 years. And, you know, as could be expected given the high celebrity nature of this case, they went on all basically a speaking tour, with the three of them basically being portrayed as, you know, saintly young men who had been railroaded by the Justice Department. And it's very similar to Jack Untwerger, who was an Australian serial killer who ended up getting released after he wrote some books from behind prison bars, and celebrities again stepped in and, you know, basically lobbied for him to be released, only for him to come to the United States and continue with his murders. So Hollywood really knows how to pick the winners, in my opinion. Anyways, the prosecutor in the case caught a lot of flack from the people of Arkansas, and despite what has been said by the West Memphis 3 supporters, a lot of the parents were still, and still are, angry over the fact that their children's murderers were released from prison. I know that the Hobbses and the Moores do not believe that they are innocent, despite what the supporters of the West Memphis 3 try and portray. And I'm going to illustrate this by reading a letter that Todd Moore had sent out. I am the father of West Memphis triple murder victim Michael Moore. I am writing this in response to your editorial in the June 6th edition of The Sun titled Justice Unserved. It has always been my opinion that justice was served when Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly were convicted in 1994 for the brutal murder of my son and his friends. The three men who slaughtered my son were convicted by two juries that found them guilty in 1994. Despite this, the Arkansas Supreme Court generously granted the murderers the opportunity for a new evidentiary hearing to be held December 5th, 2011, to show evidence they claim proved their innocence. They could have been granted a new trial to prove these claims of evidence, instead of presenting their new evidence in open court last December. They opted to plead guilty to the murders in August of 2011 in exchange for time served. Second District Prosecuting Attorney Scott Ellington agreed to accept the defense's plea offer for vague reasons we still don't understand. Family members learned of the deal only at the last minute. The district attorney was new to the case, but whatever the rationale, this continued to make the convicts guilty as a matter of law. The defense team avoided sharing the results of the tests of everything with us by preemptively entering a guilty plea for their clients. Thanks to the plea deal, we may never know exactly what the defense found when the evidence was retested. Absence of DNA evidence does not prove the West Memphis Three are innocent. The killers washed most of the evidence away in the water-filled ditch where they drowned my son. There is plenty of other evidence to convict them in 1994 without positive DNA. Most murderers are convicted without DNA evidence. The defense attorneys for the West Memphis Three had nearly 20 years to find the real killer and failed to do so. After nearly two decades and untold millions in donated funds spent, the best they could do was find a hair that may or may not have belonged to Terry Hobbs, stepfather of victim Stevie Branch. It was allegedly found on a shoelace used to tie my son. It has never been proven to actually belong to Terry Hobbs. Even if it was Terry Hobbs' hair, that fact would prove nothing. Our sons were best friends, and my child spent considerable time in the Hobbs' home and could have picked up the hair on his shoe. This would be secondary transfer and makes the hair of no probative value. The defense has even admitted as much. Terry Hobbs did not murder my son. No credible law enforcement official believes so. Neither do Mark Byers, Mr. Bojangles, nor any of the other defense red herrings. Contrary to your editorial, it is not up to police or the prosecutor to continue to look for the real killer. The real killers were arrested and charged back in 1993, were found guilty in 1994, and then admitted their guilt in 2011 after getting a lucky break. To his credit, Prosecutor Ellington has stated many times that his door is open to any new leads and evidence presented to him by the West Memphis 3 defense teams. So far, nothing compelling enough to reopen the case has been presented to him. District Attorney Ellington stated as much the day your editorial appeared. This means despite the defense's grandiose claims prior to the pleas, not one iota of credible evidence has been presented to show their client's innocence or even to view the convicted as anything less than what they are as a matter of law and as a matter of fact, guilty. The West Memphis 3 defense team has been well-funded by numerous celebrities who were misinformed by the Bias Paradise Lost documentaries. These one-sided films left out nearly all the evidence that demonstrated the guilt of the West Memphis 3. They caused thousands of people to support the release of the convicted child killers with a very limited understanding of the actual facts of the case. Mr. Wessel, it appears that you, like so many others, got most of your misinformation about this case from these inaccurate documentaries. If you would take the time to dig a little deeper and actually read the case files, you would know that there was ample evidence to convict these three men for murdering my son. These documents are readily available on websites such as callahan.8k.com. Here are just a few examples of what was omitted from the documentaries. Jesse Miss Kelly confessed to the crime at least five times to police, prosecutors, even his own attorneys, with his hand on a Bible. Miss Kelly confessed the first time after less than 4 hours of police questioning. That questioning was done with permission from his father. He continued to repeatedly confess in the year that followed. Damian Echols amassed a mental health record 500 pages long in the years immediately prior to the murders. In his own handwriting, he classified himself as a homicidal, suicidal, schizophrenic sociopath just months before he brutally murdered my son. Read Damian Echols' current Twitter account to discover his deep-seated interest in skulls and the occult. There he also recently described artwork depicting a man's song off his own arm as breathtaking. In addition, Eccles is obscenely profiting off the death of my son by selling his narcissistic books, promoting his self-serving movie, and tattooing murder groupies with his mark. For $200, you can have this sociopath tattoo an X on your arm. These Twitter posts and money-making schemes are a slap in the face to me, my family, and my dead son. The movies omit the fact that these three men had no alibis. Damien Eccles and Jesse Miss Kelly's alibis completely fell apart on the stand in the 1994 trial. Jason Baldwin's attorneys didn't even bother to present an alibi. Fibers consistent with a robe in Jason Baldwin's home and a shirt in Damien Eccles' home were found on the victims. Blue candle wax found on Chris Byers' shirt was consistent with candle wax found in Damien Eccles' bedroom. The crime lab found that three different knots were used to hogtie the three victims with their own shoelaces. This points towards multiple killers rather than one killer. Witnesses say that Mr. Bojangles, the disoriented man near the crime scene that night, had a cast on one arm. No one person could have subdued and hogtied three energetic young boys, not Terry Hobbs and certainly not the one-armed Mr. Bojangles. A knife that could have been used in the murders was found in a lake behind Baldwin's home. It was a unique knife with a place to hold a compass on the end that witnesses describe as similar to one owned by Eccles. A car full of eyewitnesses placed Eccles near the crime scene, covered with dirt, on the night of the murders. Numerous friends, accomplices, and cellmates came forward with tales of confessions from all three defendants. Throughout one or even several of those facts, then there would still be enough to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I sat through those trials. The basic facts need to be put out there. Otherwise, it makes a mockery of my son's short life. So there you hear the opinion of one of the parents. In the years since, Eccles has lived first in Salem, Massachusetts, where a number of local newspapers described him as a brooding menace, and now he lives in Harlem, New York, which is a very trendy area with the wannabe artist types. When he was in prison, he tried downplaying his whole, you know, interest in the occult. I was never that into it. That's all gone out the window now. He's released a couple books on magic with a K in the vein of Aleister Crowley, who he openly admits to pretty much worshipping. I know he's put on a number of different ceremonies and things of that nature. So he's done a complete 180 from what he was stating when he was behind bars, that he really wasn't in any of that. Now he gleefully admits that he was always into it and that it's only through his power and belief in magic that he was able to get out of prison. He's put on a few different art shows that have pretty much done nothing, or Eccles' artwork is absolute crap, and it's obvious from looking at it that he has a lot of deep-seated mental issues to this day. It's all dark and mostly involves violence in one form or another. Jason Baldwin, I know he was in Texas for a while and then Oregon. He supposedly was part of, you know, some Innocence Project, not for profit, that has failed to produce anything. And he also, a few years back, maybe 4 or 5, had started a Kickstarter to write his life's work, promising the book would be released on a certain date, and it raised something like $30,000. No book has been produced to date, nor has he given any update that I am aware of. Miss Kelly has done nothing with his life other than hang out in West Memphis, drink, and get into trouble. I know he's been pulled over for drunk driving a number of times, being drunk in public, all things that technically should violate his parole and send him back to prison for the remainder of his sentence. But for some reason, the state of Arkansas has pretty much decided to just let him slide. And I suspect it's because they don't feel like dealing with his Hollywood-backed lawyers. There's also been a number of books and movies put out on the case. One was called Devil's Knot, which was pretty much universally panned. Mara Levert put out a book which was laughably bad. I believe I discussed that last week, where Baldwin claimed to basically rule the yard in prison. There was also another movie, I think it was called West of Memphis. That too was universally panned. And the one thing I haven't seen brought up anywhere is the fact that there are Son of Sam laws in this country. Which, if you don't know what that is, a Son of Sam law basically means that a convicted felon cannot make money off of the notoriety of their crimes. Well, two of these individuals have. That's Miss Kelly and Damian Eccles. And I'm wondering why they haven't been slapped with cease and desist or had their profits from these films seized by the government. But I suppose that's one of those things you can get away with when you hang out with people like Johnny Depp. So the last thing I'm going to touch on really quickly is the programs that came out in the last year or so. I think it was for the Lifetime Network. They had some firefighter who now has decided he is a criminal investigator, and he stated during this that he was gonna, you know, find the real killers during his special, and that he would, you know, expose new evidence. He didn't. It was just an idiot rehashing the same old, tired, worn-out, false narrative that the West Memphis 3's supporters have put out there. He stated in it a couple of times that he was going to force the defense to give him that DNA evidence so he could get it tested. That will never happen. He's not part of the case. If the parents of the victims can't force the defense to turn it over to them, they're not going to turn it over to that clown. And if you happen to have been unfortunate enough to sit through any of these specials that this guy did, they were just completely horrible. So that's really it so far as the West Memphis 3 go. This went much longer than I thought it would, but that's okay. It's one of those cases. As I said at the beginning, this is that one case that I am really fascinated with. And hopefully you've seen, if you've listened to the other two episodes, the actual evidence against the three men that were convicted, and understand why they were convicted, as well as why they are still convicted of the murders of Michael Moore, Stevie Branch, and Christopher Byers. Because those three boys are the real West Memphis Three, not the sleazy, slimy, convicted murderers who were able to get out of serving out their sentences because they had high-powered friends backing them. That's it for the Deathcast this week. I will be back next week with an all-new case. I think we're going to go somewhere a little nicer than Arkansas next week. If you enjoy this show, please share it with your friends on social media. Leave a 5-star review wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And until next week, stay safe and stay morbid. Thank you.
Welcome to the Deathcast.